Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Gatehouse Media bought the Columbus Dispatch in 2015 and then merged with Gannett last year, even before the 2015 buyout. And since, Central Ohio's major daily newspaper has shrunk along with the workforce that produces it. By March, another 188 Dispatch workers will be out of a job when the paper starts printing in Indianapolis. But the Dispatch is far from alone. All of this is part of a drastically changing face of local journalism across the country. In the decade before 2018, newsroom employment overall fell by 25%, and the number of newspapers by half. Coming up, we're going to talk about state government coverage issues and how what kinds of strategies are being employed in other states to manage and to keep journalism alive. Alan Miller is executive editor of the Dispatch and interim general manager of the Dispatch Media Group. That includes the This Week community newspapers. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Hey, good morning, Ann. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Consolidation of operations like printing presses, this is not new in this new world, right?
No, it's not. As we've discussed several times, the average newspaper reader may not even realize where his or her newspaper is printed. The Cincinnati Inquirer had been printed in Columbus for the past 6 years, and just starting this week is being printed in Louisville. The Toledo Blade is printed in Detroit. The Dayton Daily News is printed in Indianapolis. And all of this is toward leveraging assets and being as efficient as possible in printing a newspaper toward supporting the preservation of the core of our business, which is a local newsroom. And that's where we are with this latest move.
There has been confusion to that end about what the change means, about who covers Central Ohio and from where they cover it. The Dispatch stays at 62 North or South Broad, right?
62 East Broad.
East Broad,
we're right across from this. Yeah. We're right across from the State House. We moved around the corner from 3rd Street a few years ago, but we've been on Capitol Square for 100 years, and this is where we will remain. I was a little surprised to hear some people suggest that we're moving everything to Indianapolis. It would be very hard to cover Columbus from Indianapolis. We're not doing that. we're keeping our reporting staff strong and firmly planted in Columbus and Central Ohio to cover not only the State House, which I can see outside my window right now, but also the communities, the local and county governments, fulfilling the watchdog role that our readers and, frankly, all of those folks in government expect us to fulfill. So local reporting will remain strong.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the future of local, particularly local journalism today, in light of, you know, the past two decades of contraction in the journalism industry, particularly newspapers. My guest is Alan Miller. He's editor of the Columbus Dispatch and interim general manager of the Dispatch Media Group. A few years ago, you started what at the time was an unusual, if not unique, collaboration. And I say that because I'm actually not sure. But you started collaborating with other Ohio newspapers in addition to carrying Associated Press stories. What spurred the collaboration and how does it work?
Well, you're right about that. It was, if not the first, it was on the forefront of something that started to sweep the nation in the early 2000s, mid 2000s, and here's what it entails: the 8 largest news organizations in Ohio, newspapers, came together and decided that we can be more effective and more efficient in covering important issues and happenings in Ohio if we put aside our pride about, you know, who arrived at a scene first or who was going to cover the big trial in Akron, and decided, you know, From Columbus, I don't have to send a reporter to Akron to cover a big federal trial that involves somebody from Columbus. I can rely on the Akron Beacon Journal to do it. Or if a big news story breaks in Cincinnati, the Inquirer. Or Toledo, for example, when the big algae outbreak occurred and their water system was shut down for many days. We know the folks at the Toledo Blade. They're very good reporters, and we relied on them to cover that for us. And the agreement is that among these eight news organizations, we can share content on cycle, which means I can have it in the Dispatch on the same day that the Toledo Blade publishes it, and there's no money that transfers back and forth. We don't pay each other for this except through internet traffic. And so we don't post each other's stories on our websites. We link back to, in that case, the Toledo Blade story, so that in essence they get paid for the traffic to their website.
So I can read it if I already get the print version. I can read it, but if I go online to my e-version or the web version, I have to pay for it.
Well, you'd be directed to the Toledo Blade story.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. And I think it's important in this whole conversation about where newspapers are printed to keep in mind that there are more eyeballs than ever on the content that we produce when you consider the traffic to all of our websites. I mean, the Dispatch website, our traffic increased almost 20% year over year in the past year. And that's no small thing. We can't lose sight of the fact that this is in the digital age, people are looking for, there's an insatiable appetite for news. So I don't want anybody to think that, there's a waning interest in local news. And in fact, I think it's the opposite, because this traffic to all of our respective websites shows that there's a very strong interest in it. So these efficiencies that we're trying to gain through the printing process, which is super expensive, mm-hmm. we're applying to the core of the business, which is the local reporting that appears in print and online.
We know other newspapers have stopped publishing the print version. Now the Cleveland Plain Dealer, I think it's still circulates the print version a couple times a week, but I may be even wrong about that. Of course, you and I both remember the day when they all had their own news boxes down around Capitol Square, and there was a raft of them from all over the state, if not the country. Is it an inevitability that the Dispatch goes that route as well? I think Mike Curtin, former editor, said it's not if, it's when.
He may be right about that. It's not being discussed at this time.
Okay.
And the Cleveland model is that they still print every day, but they don't do home delivery
every day. Okay.
And some other newspapers have followed that. Not many that I know of. We know that people want their paper daily, and our goal is to keep that happening for as long as people want to receive it.
We're going to be turning to the issue of Statehouse reporting, and I know the Dispatch has continued a firm commitment to that and investigative reporting, and I'm wondering how you figured those priorities into your budget, because, I remember the days when the Akron Beacon Journal had five reporters at the Statehouse and the Cleveland Plain Dealer had six reporters covering the Statehouse, and on and on and on. How do you manage to have the staff covering state government that you do?
Well, we still have six reporters covering state government and politics, and at the state level, we also have other reporters who cover specialty beats such as the environment or health and healthcare, who also move in and out of the state government realm, if you will, because there are regulatory bodies that they cover, or when the legislature takes action that affects some of those areas, then they'll also move in and help with the six who are assigned to that beat to cover those specific topics. So we make a huge commitment to that, because It is by virtue of geography and importance, news importance, a franchise for the Dispatch. We're literally across the street. We know people not only in Columbus but across the state and the nation are counting on us to deliver the best coverage possible of state government and politics. And so we have key priority coverage areas that we have planted a flag in, and that's one of them. Buckeyes coverage is another. Some of these specialty beats and investigative reporting. You're absolutely right. We continue to have a team that covers these sometimes very difficult topics, such as hazing. We had a big series on hazing on college campuses in the past year. We looked at the very troubled situation on Sullivan Avenue, just, you know, stone's throw from down the gleaming towers of downtown, and mm-hmm. and all the problems that are going on there. We looked at a foreclosure scam that was going on under the noses of some of the public officials here, and bilking people who should have, you know, people who are at their lowest point. They've lost their homes in foreclosure, and they had equity in those homes that they didn't realize, and some people swooped in and took that from them, and it happened repeatedly, and we were able to expose that, and as a result, there was a significant crackdown on that practice.
Alan Miller, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
You bet. Good talking with you, Ann.
That's Alan Miller. He's editor of Columbus Dispatch. He is interim general manager of the Dispatch Media Group, which includes this week's newspapers. We will now turn to the issue of state government reporting and the challenges of that. State news coverage has been hit hard in recent years, with fewer than one in three U.S. newspapers employing dedicated statehouse reporters. That number is expected to drop. Ohio Capital Journal launched last month to provide an alternative online-only news outlet dedicated to state government. Dave DeWitt is editor of the Ohio Capital Journal. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
What's your mission?
Our mission is, as you mentioned, statehouse press corps have been dwindling as we've seen newspapers consolidate and shut down over the last several decades. And the Ohio Capital Journal is part of the state's newsroom, a 501c3 nonprofit. And it was conceived after a study quantifying those dwindling state press corps. And the idea is to put experienced journalists back into the state house to do really good investigative journalism, really good data journalism, really good journalism connecting policy to people's lives and how what happens, or in some cases what doesn't happen in the state house, actually impacts people. And then to put all of this online and offer it for, it's free of advertising, free to readers, and free for republication to any other news media outlet.
But nothing's free. So one of the conversations that's going on in the nonprofit strategy is not new, and it's growing. But who are you beholden to? That's what any reader would ask. Some
right.
people think newspapers or the conventional media is beholden to the advertisers, for example, or something else.
Right. So State's Newsroom is a 501c3 nonprofit. It's funded by a coalition of donors, and each of our outlets, we have about 12 or 13 of them now.
Around the country,
are also reader-supported through donations from readers on the website. And they're also supported by grants and partnerships with other news media organizations. But the thing that remains the same between the traditional model and our model is that wall between the advertising department in the traditional model, for instance, and sources of funding, in our case, the donations. So I've put a firewall up between my newsroom and any sources of funding so that my reporters are walled off from that, I'm walled off from that, and we can focus mostly just on doing the best journalism possible covering Ohio government.
So what's a typical an editorial meeting for you? How are you identifying where the gaps are, where things aren't getting covered? Because I imagine that's part of your strategy, what's not getting covered.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're we believe deeply in journalism. We believe in supporting journalism. All of us come from community journalism backgrounds. Most of us worked at small town community newspapers for most of our careers. So, and as I mentioned that, I should also mention that I think it's important for all of us to subscribe to our local hometown papers because community journalism is so important. But what we're focused on doing is complementing and expanding on the work of the existing State House Press Corps. I think they do a lot of great stuff. There's some really great journalists doing really good stories. And we want to cover the things that they might have not have time or capacity to cover. So we can do deeper investigations into issues that they might not be able to, or we can go to committee meetings where they're not able to send somebody to those committee meetings. And one of the things that I really like about this is we have a lot of independence. I'm able to give my journalists a lot of independence in story selection, what they want to work on.
Because you're not geographically obligated.
Correct. Yeah. And they can, they really get to spread their wings, as it were, as journalists and decide what it is that they want to cover, where they see gaps in coverage, what they think is interesting, and how we can all work together to complement and expand on the work of the existing State House Press Corps.
So give me an example of something you've done that exemplifies, to be redundant, that.
Yeah, so there's two things that I would point to. One of them is there's a lot of stuff that happens in these State House committee hearings that just don't get covered because people are focused on larger stories, more involved stories, you know, print requirements or whatever. We can actually go to those committee meetings and cover the back and forth, which are sometimes pretty wild exchanges, and kind of show what's actually happening. If the public went to the State House themselves, and I think Molly Ivins used to call it the greatest free show on earth, going to your state capitol and watching the goings on there.
Yes.
And we can actually cover that back and forth, you know, and because we're online only, we don't have print concerns to worry about or space or column inch concerns. We can really just go in there and do that. The other aspect that I see is we can cover some more interesting things. One of our biggest stories was about a rail transit idea and how Ohio could implement that. And it got a ton of attention. People are really interested in it, but it's not something that you would just normally see covered with relation to state government.
What are you seeing as far as the people who are following you now and the people who are reading you? What do you know about them?
There's
so
a lot
far,
of people.
You've only been up and running a couple months.
Right.
So.
Yeah. So it's been interesting. What I'm really proud of is that we have a wide cross-section of ideological readers.
How do you know that?
Just judging anecdotally from our Facebook and Twitter reactions and comments and stuff like that. There seems to be, luckily people are being fairly responsible with their debates, but I see a wide variety of perspectives in the debates that happen on our pages, which is interesting to me, and I'm happy for that. The other thing that I think are most of our readers are people involved in government who are paying close attention to state government and really want to know kind of the nitty-gritty details about stuff going on.
It's kind of an irony, I think, that now, you know, I used to basically get the newspaper, every newspaper in the state for free because I was a State House Press Corps member. And, you know, they'd have the clips in the olden days and you'd go to the press room and you'd see the clips from all over the state, or you could just go buy the newspapers in the box across the street or inside the State House even. But I couldn't afford to subscribe to every newspaper individually. And now I can because the online versions are so affordable.
Right.
Comparatively.
The digital subscriptions.
Subscriptions, right. Do you envision a time when you will charge, or are you going to, or can you not charge because of this 501c3 status?
No, we don't intend to ever start charging people. We will send requests, you know, support community journalism, donate if you wish, type emails and things like that. But we're not going to put our content behind a paywall or make people subscribe or subject them to advertising.
What looks like success to you at this point? What are you shooting for?
What we really get excited about is when our stories are republished by other newspapers, which has happened a decent amount so far. We get excited about that because we're supporting community newspapers. I come from a community newspaper. I know what it's like to deal with those types of budgets and trying to fill space while you have to cut content and stuff like that. So I get excited about that. We get excited about social media attention and amplification. We get excited about when we can lead the narrative on stories, when we can get out there ahead and, you know, do really good reporting and deep dives into issues, and other media follows up and continues that coverage and that type of reporting. So really it's about having an impact is what we get most excited about.
Dave DeWitt, editor of the Ohio Capital Journal. It's just barely newborn online coverage of the Ohio General Assembly and state government. We'll post links to Dave on Twitter, to the Ohio Capital Journal website, on our web post on our website at wosu.org/allsides. David DeWitt, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Anne.
It's David DeWitt, editor of the Ohio Capital Journal. We're going to continue our conversation about the future of local journalism. What does it mean? What's it going to look like? How are we going to pay for it? So stay with us. Tell us what you think. 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the future of daily local journalism today. The online magazine Bridge took shape in 2011 to produce stories on topical issues for a think tank in Michigan. The nonprofit has evolved into a full-fledged news operation, providing regular news and longer investigative pieces. Bill Emko is the growth strategist for the Center for Michigan Bridge magazine. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
I first discovered you when I started working and doing research for a show on the Flint water crisis a few years back. You were doing some of the best work I could find out there on it. You're funded through memberships and philanthropic foundations. How did it come to be? Tell us about, you know, the genesis of Bridge.
The genesis started with our founder, Phil Power, who owns several weekly newspapers around the Midwest, including some in Ohio, but most of them are around the Metro Detroit area. And he held it for several decades, these newspapers, and sold to Gannett in, I think it was 2006, if I remember correctly, or 2005. It was before I was here. And Phil started the Center for Michigan. Kind of the concept of Center for Michigan was to be a think tank that would be a pragmatic think tank, where it's a think and do tank, where they would bring politicians together to try to find common ground on major issues, kind of away from the camera. And the Center for Michigan provide studies and analysis on major issues such as early childhood education, among others. And eventually, because it was started by a newspaper publisher, and the CEO of the Center for Michigan was John Bebo, who's a longtime investigative reporter and reporter around Michigan and Metro Detroit. It kind of just evolved into a kind of a news organization, hiring investigative journalists, enterprise journalists, project journalists to kind of find this data and information. And born out of that in 2011 was Bridge Magazine, which was to pick up the slack where some of the newspapers were not doing kind of the Sunday deep dives like they had used to. And we've evolved since then to be more on a day-to-day basis at this point. But that's kind of the genesis of Bridge Magazine.
Even when I moved to Ohio in 87, even by then, Michigan, most of the major dailies were all owned by, well, at the time, I think Newhouse News. There had already been a lot of concentration of news. The State House reporting, for instance, there were only a few different outlets that covered it at that point, right?
Well, yeah. So there was the Detroit News and the Free Press, mm-hmm. And then there were the Newhouse-owned papers, which I worked with at MLive.com, which mm-hmm. That's like the Grand Rapids Press and the Ann Arbor News and the Kalamazoo Gazette and the Flint Journal. Mm-hmm. While I was there, I had taken on many roles over 18 years, including state news director and sports director and editor-in-chief, various roles at different times. But when I was at MLive, we tried to beef up the State House coverage because we saw a massive rollback by the Lansing State Journal and every other organization where there might be one person covering it, including AP might have one person covering the entire state. So it had been attempted, but the model just didn't seem to support it at MLive. And now at Bridge, that's where the focus is not just state capital reporting, but health and environment and education that impacts the whole state. And while these might be more deeper dives, more revelatory journalism, there is a market for it. It just doesn't look like the same market of a commercial media news organization.
How do you afford to give your reporters a living?
Well, again, our founder, Phil Power, has been committed to this organization and is committed into the future of this organization. So a good chunk of our budget, I think it's a third of our budget, is the goal. It's more than that at this point, is he's going to support a third of our budget. And then we have foundations and philanthropies, several, over 40 foundations and philanthropies that support local journalism in Michigan. And then of course, there's, you know, earned revenue, which is like reader revenue. And we've got a lot of room to grow. But we're very well funded and very well supported well into the future.
We're really familiar with the idea of membership in public media.
Absolutely.
And I was going to ask you specifically, how is that going? Because you've more recently have embarked in that asking readers for donations, right? Or do you just do it once a year?
No, actually, it's been an evolution. Like everything's an evolution. So when the Center for Michigan began as a nonprofit organization, you know, the people that gave to the organization were people that kind of believed in the true mission, just like any nonprofit. As it's gone forward, it turned into, with Bridge, being just donate if you like the coverage. But what really opened our eyes is we were invited in 2018 by Facebook to be a part of the Facebook Membership Accelerator, which is put on by the Facebook Journalism Project. And, you know, there's some reluctance after what happened in 2016 with news on Facebook as to what's Facebook up to, is kind of the thought. But really what Facebook's goal was to give a 12-week intensive program by bringing in some of the best and brightest in the industry in terms of monetizing news and teaching us, we were one of 17 organizations, to how to generate revenue out of readers through memberships and not subscriptions, because as a nonprofit, we don't want to be behind any kind of paywall. We want to make sure the news is out there. But how do you compel people to give? And our coaches through the project were people that were C-level executives at the New York Times when they launched their subscription service. And then one of them had moved on to the Texas Tribune, which is a large nonprofit news organization that's kind of our not so much our model, but our inspiration for what mm-hmm. we want to be. And we learned an awful lot out of that program. And so we've taken we now have a membership director, and I work with the membership director as well as the editors, and we try to figure out basically what are the methodologies to generate revenue? How do we compel people to give and support news? And yes, it's been going extraordinarily well. We just closed out 2019 with a 40% increase in our reader revenue over 2018. So we're doing very well with what, and we're just, you know, how do we change up and how do we innovate for 2020 is where we're at right now.
What do you know about who your readers are? I mean, for one thing, how many are there out there that were willing to donate?
We have 3,500 members. It's a rolling membership, so it's for, you know, 1 year. Mm-hmm. When you can give us as little as $1, because we figure not everybody can afford it. And if you're willing to try, we don't want to set a dollar amount on what you should. We ideally prefer people to give $10 a month or $15 a month. But if somebody can only afford $1, which a lot of people will email us and say, I lived on a fixed income and this is all I can afford, and it's like, that's fine. Now, and that's just true. We love those messages when people say things like that they care enough to actually make that move. Mm-hmm. But that's 3,500 that give to us regularly, anywhere from $1 to thousands and thousands of dollars per year. So it's very similar to the NPR model. And who they are, you know, we look at it as people that are interested, in news, people that are educated in the state of Michigan that want to keep up with it. So we look at, our ultimate top of the funnel. There's 10 million people in Michigan. There's probably about 3 million of them that fit the criteria of educated, very interested and engaged in news, and interested in the future of where Michigan is going. So that's what we're trying to get at. That's the challenge every day.
How do you get at local news? What are there any aspirations in that direction?
Well, we do cover mostly statewide, but every statewide story is fed by a local example, and that's what comes from great reporters, veteran reporters that have tentacles all over the state of Michigan. We haven't done a ton in an individual local market, although almost every place that we, where we know people, that their desire is they're tired of the clickbaity news websites that are kind of out there now in commercial media, there have been a lot of organizations have asked us if we'd be willing to do a local market, like a whether it be a Flint market or even an Ann Arbor market or a Kalamazoo market or whatever. And so we're exploring ideas on how to do it. But again, the whole thing is sustainability. It's not, we may be a nonprofit, but it's not a charity. We got to find places that are willing to help us get off the ground in a market and be sustainable. Otherwise, that's something we're always looking for.
We knew that change was coming, decades ago now, 20, 30 years ago, 15 years ago, it became extreme change was coming. You'd try to describe it at the time. And when I was in the newspaper business, I would kind of describe it as sort of like a rope bridge over a very deep canyon. And the question was, are we going to get across that rope bridge as it unravels, which it inevitably will, in time to make something new at the other side, right? And it is interesting to see how this is happening, how it might absolutely morph back into local news coverage, but it's going by way of this larger statewide model at this point. Is there anything that's surprising you about this? As you've been crossing the rope bridge too with me. What surprises you? What doesn't surprise you?
Well, this is my 22nd year in digital media, and it's been frustrating for me to see the models come and go. Mm-hmm. And I know there's a lot of criticism of news organizations. I'm hesitant to use the word clickbait because, again, I think everybody that's trying to do something, I think is a warrior and a champion. And I appreciate every effort to try. I think when the changes started happening, not just started, I mean, it's been going on for a long, long, long time.
Yeah.
But even from the 90s on, I think a lot of people have they should have had a walled paywall from the start. And, once you give it away for free, you'll never be able to get people to pay for it. I've heard this several times, but if you take us back in the Wayback Machine at the mid-90s, it was the heyday of money-making for newspapers even at that point. And I do know, like, even the new houses were trying to do things differently, very differently. And I think there's a lot of criticism in the rearview mirror. But at the time, there was AOL back in the day. And if you sign up for AOL, that was your walled garden where all the news was living inside of. And it failed because of the popularity of Yahoo and Google. And so I think when stuff became free, even AOL went to free, and then the advertising model seemed to be the way to go, and the advertising model collapsed. If anything, my criticism might be that news organizations, commercial news organizations, have not modified fast enough to stick with it. I think a lot of them are very large news organizations. Again, I worked for Gannett for a while and working for the new houses. It's hard to turn a battleship in a bathtub. And that's what it's like when you have a big monolithic organization that has, hundreds of people doing certain jobs, and then you're saying, okay, now everything has to change. You have to do this differently.
And everybody has to do it all at once.
Everybody has to do it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I like where we're at. I'm in a small nonprofit. I believe in the mission. I believe in what we do. But when we try to implement changes, it's not hard to do. It's always a lot of explanation, and we have to have proof of concept. And yes, we have to see things have to work, right? Mm-hmm. But it's easy to shift when you're a small organization than it is when you're thousands of people.
We're going to continue our conversation about journalism and the future of journalism. My guest is Bill Emko. He's growth strategist at the Center for Michigan's Bridge Magazine. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. So stay with us. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In the decade before 2018, newsroom employment overall fell by 25%. The number of newspapers fell by half. We're talking about the future of local journalism today and what that means nationally. Collaboration is one key to its survival. Funding is another. Still with us is Bill Emko. He's growth strategist for the Center for Michigan Bridge Magazine. We'll have a link to their website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Rick Edmonds is the media business analyst for the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. It's a nonprofit journalism school and research organization in Florida. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Good to be back with you, Ann.
Let's talk about the collaboration piece of this and how it's contributing to the survival of news organizations.
Sure.
We were talking earlier about how the Columbus Dispatch and, you know, the eight biggest newspapers basically in the state of Ohio are collaborating now, and that's happening all over the country.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a big plus. The paper that we're affiliated with, the Tampa Bay Times, began sharing a Capital Bureau with the Miami Herald 10 years ago, and that's been very helpful, runs very smoothly. Some of the same in Texas. I would point out that local NPR stations, like NPR affiliates like yours, have been expanding, and
right.
There's a particular push on now for them to work cooperatively too, and in some cases even go beyond one state border if there's a regional issue. And the nonprofit organizations, going all the way up to ProPublica, or I talked to a friend at Inside Climate News, which has won a Pulitzer Prize, they're generally offering their content for free, or you can adapt it. So there's quite a lot going on in terms of sharing and pooling. That still doesn't exactly get at the sort of nitty-gritty local coverage that newspapers traditionally provided of their hometown, and you know they would quit that, but they just can't afford to do as much as they used to.
Right. I mean, I cut my teeth trying to figure out what a drainage tile was covering the Sparta Village Council. Right. You know.
Right,
so
right.
I get that, and that's not happening as much. The Texas Bill Emko and I were talking about that too. They are not getting down into that nitty gritty thing. But I'm wondering, Bill Emko, are you recruiting journalists who have a familiarity with those kind of issues, those, you know, down in the trenches sort of things, so that they have that sort of background?
Yeah, actually, this year we'll be working on launching a Detroit edition of Bridge.
Okay.
And, you know, funded by the Knight Foundation and others, is we're still ramping up on it, but that's on the horizon in 2020. But the thing to consider when looking at a local market is, you know, not one size fits all. And so when we're talking about if we expand into Detroit, is a website or an email newsletter the most effective way to reach people in ways that they haven't been reached before? Maybe it's using different social medias. Maybe it's trying things differently. Maybe it isn't a story. Maybe it's short videos. If you do something like that, is it different than what the local TV stations are doing? So there's a lot of questions to be asked as you go forward and look into local markets. In some markets, you know, translating a news product that would be recognized as a news product, even if it wasn't a newspaper, is not hard to do, even if you find the right reporters and you find the great reporting that goes behind it and the great editors. But really, at the end of the day, will they be consumed in that market? Because at the end of the day, it's going to be supported by someone. You have to pay salaries somehow.
Wow.
And it's going to either be by readers or it's going to be foundations. And we're looking at combinations of all those things. And so, we talk about a local market. You got to say, okay, is there enough reader support that could happen there? And is there a foundation support that can happen there? And ideally, you don't want to get caught on just one. You do foundations for several years, and you know, then it's a constant cycle of renewing. If you get readers to support you, that's usually the ultimate freedom. But are there enough people willing to do it in a market? So there's a lot of things to be considered when looking at local market reporting.
Rick Edmonds, tell us about the Texas Tribune. It's partly inspired Bridge Magazine going forward. Why has it been an interesting case study? What have they done there?
Well, they've done a lot, and they're, along with Chalkbeat, which has education specialists, they're quite big now, I think $8 to $10 million enterprise, and they've just announced some ambitious plans for expanding. They had a lot going for them. Texas itself is a terrific market for it. Evan Smith was the CEO and editor, was very well-known media personality before it all started, and they hired terrific people on the business side, if you will, as well as the editorial side. So they're really kind of a juggernaut among locally, regionally based nonprofits.
There's the issue of the funding and people of off, you know, readers, you know, through the generations have accused newspapers of being influenced by their advertisers, that kind of a thing. Has that become an issue for the likes of Texas Tribune, you know, and others like it, like Bridge, for instance, that they slant their news?
Good question. In a little bit different way from how you asked, the Texas Tribune has a very successful events business, and events typically get their money largely through sponsors. You know, a corporation may say it's good for them, it's a good event, we'll reach people, get our brand out there. And somebody raised the question of whether some of those sponsors, I don't think there was really a notion that they were getting preferential treatment, but there's a little bit the appearance of that. So
yeah.
So they've needed to kind of tend to that.
Has it been difficult, Bill Emko, to recruit people to this mission?
To recruit people to
journalists, or are they just going away? Okay.
No, I think I've worked all over the state in various media organizations, and I think a lot of places look at Bridge as almost a destination for it, because it's the journalists that we have here are asked to do journalism, quality journalism, and it's not, you know, while it is work, it's a lot of hard work, it's just not the same volume as other news organizations that want to crank out several stories a day per reporter. You know, not that that's never happened on big news days here, mm-hmm. but that's not what the day to day is. So no, it's not hard to really recruit at all. I think there's a lot of people that want to work for Bridge. We pay well. We hire veterans, and I think we have a stellar staff.
And that's been pretty much the way it is across the country with these kinds of outfits, Rick Edmonds?
Sure. There are a lot of good available journalists. And then there are additionally, some of them may be coming out of the newspaper business, particularly even if they haven't been laid off, because mm-hmm. they see a stronger future elsewhere. And there's there are a couple of good programs. I don't know if you're familiar with Report for America.
Yes, the Dispatch, the Columbus Dispatch is involved in that.
You know, teaching core, and it's relatively new, it's third or fourth year, but they find strong young reporters with a little bit of experience and send them to a place where there's lots of news. So yeah, there's plenty of growth of journalists who are doing this kind of thing.
Is there a pattern about the kinds of organizations and foundations and individuals that will donate significantly to these nonprofit news organizations?
Yeah, I would say that, and I think Bill mentioned this, that a key source, since we're talking about local news, are locally based foundations. And you know, frankly, there are rich communities that have a lot of that and other communities where it's a lot harder to find. A second element, and I should say in disclosure, we have several big programs ourselves. Gannett and Facebook are now really investing in local news and finding different ways to do that. So that was not the case 4 or 5 years ago. That's a source of some help.
Is that, again, going to address the issue of news deserts where local newspapers have shut down and there's nothing?
That's a really good question. There's an interesting experiment, I think it is Google-funded, that McClatchy is doing of trying to start from scratch called the Compass Experiment, three news sites. And a very experienced, good woman who runs that, Mandy Jenkins, has said recently that, well, they went into Youngstown, where the newspaper had folded. She said it's a lot harder to go somewhere where there just isn't anything anymore. So, you know, then you have the people aren't necessarily even attuned that there's going to be a good source of local news. So tough problem. I think a lot of people are looking at it and trying to find a solution.
This isn't exactly a funding issue, but I wanted to ask both of you about diversity in newsrooms and whether that was already a challenge in a lot of places before this sort of digital meltdown that occurred. And now it's not like you can walk into a digital newsroom and see who's working there. It's different. Bill Emko, what kind of commitment do you have to that, given the nature of journalism today?
We're extremely committed to diversity. It is difficult because there is there's a high demand for diverse, high quality, diverse reporters, and we're even in commercial media organizations where there are, still are a lot of jobs to be had. There's a priority put on diversity everywhere, including here. It is difficult, and you know, when you're trying to find veteran reporters on various topics in recruiting out of state and getting people that know Michigan and know the landscape of what's going on, or trying to find people inside the state that are fitting the beat that you're trying to accomplish. So it's a commitment we have. Part of our Detroit newsroom will be extraordinarily diverse. That's the intent and the plan as we go forward. It is a challenge, but it is something that we're committed to solving.
What do you think, Rick Edmonds? I know it's not exactly your bailiwick, but...
Well, I don't know. I think probably ought to pass on that one. Mm-hmm. Just really not sure. I will say that diversity is as important as ever, more important than ever, mm-hmm. as our population becomes much more diverse. It hasn't necessarily been easy. It doesn't just happen by itself. But, you know, I think it's essential to keep that in mind and to support some of the ethnic press. The black press is withering on the vine, so, you know, that contributes as well.
What about foundations? Do you see any strings attached to any of the money? There may be a wall, you know, a firewall as far as what's covered, but are there any foundations out there particularly interested in diversifying newsrooms and that's what their funding is going toward? Rick?
There are some. We actually have a program here which was sponsored by one of the associations as it merged with another to train diverse leaders, and we do that at least once a year. We may do it more. There's some interest in that. I would say, though, that it doesn't seem to be, you know, maybe the biggest emphasis for the big foundations. And there's a little bit of we could use a lot more foundations interested in the whole topic and that topic too.
And Bill Emko, I'm wondering about your grant writing department. Is it growing? Is it a big part or what?
Our president and CEO does the bulk of our grant writing reporting, and we brought someone on this year to help him out to kind of organize everything to make sure that we're on top of it. Because, you know, we've expanded, we've added reporters, we've added editors in the last 2 years to keep up with the demand. And it's got to be carefully thought out. But as you expand, again, that's a lot of stress to keep up with every grant report and every in renewals and everything. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, we've added an extra person this year. I'm sure that department is going to continue to grow as we continue to meet demand.
We only have about a minute left, but I wanted to get each of you a quick thing. I mean, Rick Edmonds, high hopes. Encouraged? Thumbs up? Are we headed in the right direction?
Well, that may be more than a minute. I think the continued decline of a newspaper base is discouraging and mm-hmm. a negative, and is going to continue. But I would say the newspapers themselves, Gannett, are pivoting to digital. I talked about it for years, and they're really trying it now. I mean, plus we have, as we talked about before, freestanding digital sites and public radio and some other sources. So, you know, it's a very messy situation, but I think a good transition seems to be at least possible.
And Bill Emko, you got about 20 seconds.
Yes, I think that the future is bright, and I'm glad to be at a nonprofit news organization. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
Bill Emko, growth strategist at the Center for Michigan's Bridge Magazine. We'll have links to that. Also, Rick Edmonds, business analyst at the Poynter Institute. Thanks to you both for your time today. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.